today we'll be talking about the basic neoclassical model of labor supply. This model serves as a foundation for much of the analysis we'll be doing for the next several weeks. There's two basic assumptions we're going to make in the model. The first is that there's only two ways in which people use time. One is labor time, and the other is leisure time. What we're assuming here when we talk about leisure, well, what we're describing here by leisure is basically any use of time other than work activities. So leisure time includes time spent cooking meals, washing dishes, raising children, painting houses, repairing cars, studying for exams, going to college, acquiring new job skills, and so on. Basically, anything for which you're not paid we'll consider leisure time. So it includes things other than simple leisure time activities as we normally think of them. The second thing we're going to assume is that each individual selects a combination of hours of work and leisure that provides him or her with the highest level of possible satisfaction, what we call utility. In making choices concerning hours of work and hours of leisure, individuals have to consider their opportunity cost. Remember, the opportunity cost is the cost of not selecting the next best alternative. And for individuals who choose to work, the opportunity cost of an additional hour of leisure time is the wage rate, the income that you give up by choosing to take an hour off from work. Individuals who choose not to work, however, do so if the value of leisure time at the margin, for the last hour of leisure time consumed, received, exceeds the market wage. So individuals, we're assuming here, don't work only if the value of their leisure time is greater, the value of the non-market time more generally, is greater than the value of their time in the paid labor market. So for now, we're assuming that all unemployment is going to be voluntary. Later on in the course, we'll talk about, obviously, the possibility of involuntary unemployment. But right now, we're looking at individuals who rationally decide to either work or not work. And if they're working, we'll be looking at how they choose the optimal number of hours. When the wage rate changes, there's going to be two effects that occur. One is called the substitution effect. The other effect is the income effect. These are similar in lots of ways to the substitution and income effects that you studied in your principles of microeconomics course. Most of your discussion of substitution and income effects in introductory microeconomics, however, dealt with substitution and income effects resulting from a change in the price of a good on the quantity of the good demanded. It's possible, or it's likely, that at the very end of the course you talked about substitution and income effects on the quantity of labor supplied, but generally in most courses that discussion tends to be a little brief and it tends to be hurried towards the end of the semester. So there is going to be a bit of a difference here. Remember that when we're talking about the effects of a wage change, we're looking at an individual supply decision or a labor supply decision and not the decision to buy some good or service. When we talk about the effects of a wage increase, one effect is the substitution effect, as we just noted. The substitution effect occurs as a result of a change in the relative price of leisure time. When the wage rate goes up, the opportunity cost of leisure time is higher. In response to this higher opportunity cost, individuals choose to consume less leisure time now that it's relatively more expensive. Since there's only two ways of using time, when leisure time costs more, individuals will consume less leisure and will spend more time at work. That's a substitution effect resulting from a higher wage. Again, it's the effect due to a change in the relative price of leisure time. Second effect, though, is that income effect. And what happens here is that as the wage rate goes up, an individual has a higher level of real income, that you can end up with more income at the same level of hours. And in response to higher level of real income, individuals choose to consume more of all normal goods. If leisure is a normal good, this higher wage rate will cause the individual to consume more leisure time and reduce hours of work thereby. Individuals with a higher wage, in a sense, can afford to take more time off from work. It's what this income effect is all about. One useful way to think about it is to think about an individual who's contemplating a vacation and just hears that they've received a wage. On the one hand, now that they're getting paid more each hour, it costs more to take time off from work. If your wage rate goes from $10 an hour to $15 an hour, you're now giving up 50% more income for each hour you take off work. On the other hand, now that you're getting paid 50% more, it's easier to afford to take time off from work. So what happens here is that there's a trade-off that's going to occur. There's two effects that work in opposite directions. The substitution effect causes people to work more when the wage rate increases, and the income effect causes them to work less. Thus, if leisure is a normal good, an increase in the wage rate will cause individuals to supply more labor to the market if the substitution effect is larger than the income effect. On the other hand, an increase in the wage will cause people to supply less labor in the market if the income effect is larger in magnitude than the substitution effect. This relationship is illustrated by this diagram. It's argued that in general, at relatively low levels of the wage, the income effect tends to be smaller in magnitude than the substitution effect, and individuals choose to work more hours as the wage rate increases. On the other hand, at some wage, in this case W0, eventually the income effect rises in magnitude relative to the substitution effect, and for wages above that point, individuals choose to work fewer hours. A bit of introspection might suggest that such a wage would occur, whether such a wage would occur for you or not. Is there some level of the wage at which, when the wage goes above that level, you choose to work fewer hours each week? If the wage, for example, was $200 an hour, or $220 an hour, or $400 an hour, might you decide to work fewer hours than if the wage rate was $6 an hour? Okay. If so, then you have a backward-bending labor supply curve such as this one. If not, if you continue to work longer hours as the wage rate rises, then your labor supply curve is upward-sloping. In practice, the empirical evidence on this is somewhat mixed. Most studies for prime-age males, in any case, males between the ages of 35 and 54, as they're described, generally end up having relatively inelastic labor supply curves, which means that individuals, or males, married males particularly, between those ages, tend to work approximately 40 hours a week, no matter how low or how high the wage rate is. The labor supply curve for single females in that age group, or divorced females in that age group, also tends to be relatively inelastic. On the other hand, the labor supply curve for married females tends to be somewhat more elastic. In practice, that is most likely because of childcare responsibilities and the lower wage rates received by married women on average. That's a topic that we'll come back to a bit later in the course. But for the most part, there really is very little empirical evidence of backward-bending labor supply curves, at least not in the aggregate sense. But it certainly is a theoretical possibility, and that for some individuals, or at least for some portion of the population, it's quite possible that as the wage rate rises beyond some point, they may choose to work fewer hours. But in practice, we do tend to observe upward-sloping labor supply curves or relatively inelastic labor supply curves. Now, if we want to analyze this choice, a very useful tool for doing this in terms of the number of hours of work and leisure is to use indifference curves. Back in your principles course, you also use indifference curves to analyze a mix of goods that are consumed. Now, though, we're going to use indifference curve analysis and budget constraints to discuss the labor supply decision. An indifference curve, you should recall, is a graph of alternative combinations of goods that provides a given level of satisfaction or utility. In the basic neoclassical model of labor supply, we assume that utility is a function of only two goods. One is real income, which we label Y, and the other is leisure time. In mathematical terms, we write the utility function as U is some function U of Y and L. And what happens here is we're assuming that the marginal utility of both Y and L are positive. In other words, as individuals receive more income, their utility rises. As they receive more leisure time, their utility rises. Here we have a possible indifference curve for an individual. Notice that this indifference curve is sloping, and this negative slope indicates that the individual is willing to give up some income to receive additional leisure, or vice versa. That individuals, since they place the positive values of both on both Y and L, are willing to trade off one for another. In particular, if individuals receive a higher income, they'd be willing to give up some leisure, or individuals would be willing to give up some leisure to acquire more income. On the other hand, individuals might be willing to give up some income to acquire additional leisure time. The shape of the indifference curve and the curvature somehow reflects the rate at which they're willing to trade off income for leisure. When the indifference curve is relatively steep, as occurs at the top of the curve, that suggests that there's a relatively high trade-off, or that it requires a relatively large increase in income to give up leisure time. As the indifference curve becomes relatively flat, as occurs on the bottom right portion of the curve, it requires a relatively small amount of income to compensate for the loss of leisure time. I think for most people, this probably makes a fair amount of sense. That when you have a large amount of leisure time, the value of the last hour of leisure time is likely to be low, and it requires a small amount of income to compensate for giving up some of that. Or you'd be willing to give up an hour each week if you're only consuming leisure at a relatively small cost. It wouldn't require a very large payment of additional income to cause you to give up some of that leisure. But as you move to the left and up along this curve, you have less and less remaining leisure time. And each additional hour that you give up involves giving up things that are worth relatively more to you. For example, if you're spending 60 hours a week at leisure time and you start working an hour a week, an hour or two a week, you might end up giving up all things such as all washing dishes, cleaning the house, or other things that are relatively, on which you place a relatively low value. But as your leisure time is reduced to the point where you may only have, say, 10 or 15 hours left, or 5 or 6 hours of leisure time left each week, it's going to require a larger and larger amount of additional income to give up those additional hours, because you're giving up activities that are worth relatively more to you. That's why we expect these indifference curves to have this convex shape. Any point that lies above an indifference curve provides a higher level of utility than a point on the curve. To see that, compare the point A to a point which lies strictly below and to the left on the indifference curve. Because point A provides a higher level of income and a higher level of leisure time, it should be fairly obvious, since both of those things provide positive marginal utility, that point A provides for point A yields a higher level of satisfaction. That if you get more of both Y and L, you're better off than having the same amount or less. And since all the points on the indifference curve are literally indifferent to all the other points on the indifference curve, point A is strictly preferred to any point on the indifference curve U equals U0. We should note that there's an indifference curve that progresses through each possible point in the diagram. Here we've added the indifference curve that goes through point A. Obviously, there's an infinite number of potential points here. We're just illustrating a couple of them to show the general pattern of indifference curve. In general, they're downward sloping curves, and they're expected to be convex. And as you move outward and to the right, the level of utility will be higher. If we take a point that lies between the indifference curves, U0 and U prime, the level of utility at that point would be greater than U0, but less than U prime. Any point which lies below the indifference curve U0 would provide a lower level of utility. Now, in general, when individuals are making this choice, though, they're not free to choose any possible combination of income and leisure. Obviously, people, given the choice of any possible combination of income and leisure, would choose to spend perhaps, or many individuals at least, would choose to spend all their time at leisure and would choose to have an extremely high level of income, perhaps an infinite income. However, the choice is constrained, as most choices are in economics. And in particular, we assume that there's two constraints that limit the possible combinations of income and leisure. The first constraint we call a time constraint. The second constraint we call a goods constraint. The time constraint is given by H plus L equals T. Here we define H as hours of work, L as hours of leisure, and T as the total amount of time available. Here we're going to use a very simple static model where there's one period where people have to allocate the time between hours of work and hours of leisure. Again, these are the only two things that are available to them. So basically, you're either working or you're not working, and the hours you spend working plus the time you spend not working, which we call L, add up to all the available time, cap T. The goods constraint is given by WH equals PY. Here, W is the wage rate, H is the total number of hours of work as defined on the previous screen, P is a price index for real income, and Y is the level of real income Here, obviously, there's a few simplifications that are going on. One is this is a single period model, so we don't have the possibility of borrowing or lending. We're assuming that there's this single time period where people decide how many hours they're going to work in that, and it's not possible to transfer incomes from the current period into future periods or from past periods to this. This is a simplification that makes the analysis dramatically simpler and doesn't significantly affect any of the results that we're going to be getting in this model. More complex models require higher level dimensions and can't be easily represented on a computer screen or on a blackboard. So that's the first simplification. So we're going to assume that this holds as an equality since there's no incentive to save income because there's no way of spending in the future. If we were to allow for the possible future consumption, then we could say that current income would be greater than or equal to the level of expenditures. But here we're assuming that all income is spent. The left side of this equation is wages times hours work, which is a nominal income, the number of dollars received from working. We're also assuming for simplicity at this point, this will be relaxed very shortly, that all income comes from labor income. And if labor is the only source of income, the wage rate times hours worked is your total income. And we're assuming that the wage is determined in the market and is exogenous to the individual. That is, the individual is not able to affect the wage by varying their hours of work. The second assumption, the right-hand side of this equation, is PY. P is the price index for the output that people buy, and Y is a measure of real output, a real income. That Y here is what we call in economics an aggregate commodity. It's an index of the total quantity of output that individuals consume. Roughly speaking, we can think of Y as the total quantity of stuff that people buy. We're not concerned in this model about whether they're buying CDs, whether they're going to movies, whether they're buying new cars, whether they're buying gasoline, whether they're buying textbooks, we're not concerned in general with how they allocate their spending. We just think of Y as being the total quantity of goods and services they buy, and P is a measure of the price level of that. The price index here is analogous to the price, is basically the same type of price index we talked about earlier in the course. If this makes you feel more comfortable, you can think of P as being the CPI, a measure of the price of consumer goods, for example. Now we're going to combine these two constraints. The first constraint, again, equation one is the time constraint. Equation two is the goods constraint. We can rewrite equation one as H is equal to T minus L. Substituting this into equation 2, we end up with Py is equal to W times the quantity T minus L, or Py equals WT minus WL, as appears on the bottom of the screen. With a little bit of algebraic manipulation, I think what we ended up doing here is just adding WL to both sides. We end up with the equation 3 here, WT equals Py plus WL. This equation is called a full income constraint. Full income is defined to be an individual's maximum earnings potential. In this case, since the only way you can receive income or earnings here is through supplying labor, the maximum earnings potential an individual could receive is a wage rate times T, where T is the total number of available hours. Basically, the highest income someone could earn is if they spend every available hour working. So the left-hand side is the total amount of full income. The right-hand side is an individual's explicit expenditures on commodities, or the first term, TY is an individual's explicit expenditures on commodities. The second term, WL, is the opportunity cost of leisure time. Because you notice again, L is the quantity of leisure that an individual consumes, and the wage rate is the opportunity cost. So here we have, on the right-hand side, two costs, the explicit cost of goods and services and the implicit cost, or the opportunity cost, of leisure time. And what this is suggesting is that an individual can choose to allocate their full income, their earnings potential, their earnings capacity, by either spending it on goods and services, the PY term, or by consuming leisure time, by choosing not to earn the income and consume leisure instead. And basically, you can choose any combination of leisure and income that satisfies this equation. But the more of your potential earnings you spend on leisure time, the less is available for purchase of goods and services. Alternatively, the more of your earnings potential you spend on actual goods and services, the less you have available to spend on leisure time. Manipulating this just a little bit more and solving this equation for Y, we have this alternative form of the budget constraint, or this alternative constraint, which we normally just call an individual's budget constraint. This states that income is equal to a negative W over P times L plus W over P times T. This equation describes a relationship that exists between real income on the left-hand side, Y, and the quantity of leisure time. There's a little mistake on this slide, sorry about that. It should say the relationship that exists between hours of leisure time and real income. Okay, I should have corrected that. At some point it will be corrected, but right now it's not. And this equation gives us a relationship, which is a linear relationship between income and the quantity of leisure. And you notice W over P is the real wage, which we're assuming is determined exogenously, separate from the individual, and W over P times T is also a constant. So we have income is equal to a constant times L plus another constant times T. Now, if we want to graph this relationship, the first thing we can note is that the intercept of the budget constraint on a horizontal axis has to equal T. And that's because T is the maximum amount of leisure time that an individual can receive. On the horizontal axis, you notice that leisure varies from 0 to T as we move in the rightward direction. On the other hand, because H plus L equals T, we can note that when L is equal to 0, H must equal T. When L is equal and leisure time is equal to T, hours of work must equal 0. Therefore, as we move to the right along the curve, the individual consumes more leisure time but works fewer hours. Alternatively, a leftward movement would result in less leisure but more hours of work. Given our earlier equation, we can note that the intercept of the budget constraint on the vertical axis must equal WT over P. Back in that other equation, we had Y was equal to a constant times L, which is a variable on the horizontal axis, plus another constant where that constant was WT over P. That's basically, the equation was already in the standard slope-intercept form, where the second constant, WT, that quantity divided by P, is, analogous to the B in the Y equals MX plus B formulation. So what we have here is the intercept on the vertical axis for the budget constraint is WT over P. Notice that WT is the nominal value of full income. If we divide the nominal value of full income by the price index P, we end up with the real value of full income. The slope of the budget constraint is equal to a negative W over P, which was a constant multiplying L in the equation. Y is equal to constant times L plus WT over P. Notice the slope is equal to the negative of the real wage. As the real wage rises, the budget constraint would pivot upward, the intercept on the horizontal axis would stay the same. As the real wage decreases, the budget constraint would pivot downward and become flatter. Now we're going to combine the indifference curves with the budget constraint, and we note that the highest level of utility occurs at a point of tangency between an indifference curve and the budget constraint. That provides us with the highest level of utility that can be achieved given this individual's wage, given this number of available hours, given this price level, and so on. So basically, this individual faced with this budget constraint and these preferences would choose to work H star hours, consume L star hours of leisure, and would receive a real income of Y star. In the next topic we'll look at changes in the wage and how that affects the quantity of labor supply.